For those few of you who are new here today, and I noticed a couple of you, let me first say that I am not Asha, and this is not David, although they are listed in your program that you have. But when they realized that there were a few of us here who could in fact support Sunday service today, they took advantage of spending an extra day up in Portland, Oregon, where they are with a group of Ananda people probably from all over the world, dedicating a new piece of property, a new project in Portland, along with Swami Kriyananda, who founded all of Ananda. So yesterday was going to be the actual dedication of that land, and then Swamiji was going to give Sunday service today. So Friday, we got the email. Anybody want to give service? Of course we said yes, of course, because we're all so aware of this amazing blessing of being in the company, first of so many people from Ananda, and the energy, the joyful energy that is awakened in those circumstances, and particularly, of course, with Swami Kriyananda there. Many years ago, I had a really profound experience. Some of you have heard me tell this story before, but it's one of those stories that is definitely worth telling. I came to a moment in my life where I was deeply confused about where I was to go next, how I was to do that. I actually started questioning everything about myself, everything. I got into a frame of mind that I can only describe as some indescribable piece of karma, because so much came up about me that is not anything I had seen in myself before. But suffice it to say that I started remembering in that period of time everything I had ever done wrong to anybody. I had memories that went back to the time I was 4, if I told a little fib, and I mean, there were things on there that I had been taught were wrong, like when my father had his first heart attack and everybody was trying to tell his mother, my grandmother, that he just had a little illness. And I just marched in as a little kid and said, "Granny, this just isn't right. Everybody's lying to you. Daddy had a big heart attack." My whole family was very upset with me. All those things. And then, of course, there were some rather serious things, betrayals and lies that I did tell and ways that I behaved in the world. But I got obsessionally into this for about 3 days. I started making lists. And I started deciding over those days that I was unworthy to teach anymore, to practice medicine anymore. I had just left a place where I had had the third largest medical practice in the country. Some of you know that. And I was deciding I couldn't practice medicine. I was very quickly spiraling downward. It was hardly a spiral. It was like a free fall. And I was in the midst of a many month long period of mostly silence. But this time in particular, I had 3 weeks at a friend's home in Portola Valley, and I was completely in seclusion for 3 weeks. So I went into her little sitting room, her meditation room, and I said to God, "I need some answers from you. I've been out in the world, I've been doing a lot, and I'm planning on moving into this spiritual community." This was right before I moved into the community. And suddenly, I just feel like I have no right or reason to be in front of anybody, teaching anything, sharing anything. I need you to talk to me. And I said to God, "I'm going to sit here. I will not move. I won't eat. I won't drink. I will die in this spot if I need to until you speak to me." And I said to him, "No riddles." Because very often that's how he speaks to us. And 3 years later we're saying, "Oh, that's what that meant." Or three lifetimes later, who knows. And I said, "I really mean this. I will die sitting here if I need to. But I'm not budging until you speak with me." And 4 hours later, I reminded him that I was there. 7 hours later, this is a true story, I was not about to move. And at 14 hours, I picked up this little book that somebody had given me, written by some famous Rinpoche, his name I can't remember. And I opened it up and I read this story the Buddha had told about two farmers. I know I've told this story here before, and the story is not the point of the story. Let me just say this. I read a story where God answered me completely, directly, no riddles. I got it. I was okay. I could, in fact, come back out into the world, practice medicine, move into the community, because in that story, he basically said what Sri Yukteswar said when he said, the past lives of all men are dark with many shames, but everything will be right from now on if you put one foot in front of the other on the spiritual path. And that's really what the Buddha said. He said it in his own words. It was extraordinarily relieving to me, both because I didn't have to die sitting in my friend's house, which wasn't going to be too grand, but also because I, of course, because I understood that if I spoke with that depth, meaning, intensity, committedness to God, that I would get an answer. What I realized when I was looking at this reading yesterday is that so much of what I have considered riddles were not really riddles. They were teachings that I heard or read or came across that I just wasn't prepared to understand yet. And when my understanding evolved to the point that I could take those teachings in, if I were lucky enough to have remembered the teaching, you have one of those, what I've come to call, spiritual epiphanies. You get something, and you get it with great clarity. Our reading today is from the Beatitudes, which we all know, it's the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And it's not in our reading today, but when you read about the Sermon on the Mount, it says something like, Jesus noticed the multitudes. He went up on the mountain, and it says very clearly, and when he was set, that's the words from the Bible, which is never really explained, but to me, or I've never read an interpretation of it, I'm sure there are many, but I haven't read one, but I'm sure it means, probably for Jesus, it meant when he was in a state of samadhi, of pure bliss, of pure oneness with God, the disciples came. So his 12 disciples came, and he opened his mouth and taught them. That's what it says. And that lets us, well, of course, we can see many things in that. First of all, that he chose not to speak to the multitudes. Yogananda says, in one of his commentaries on the Sermon on the Mount, he says, Jesus preferred one seeking soul to crowds of curiosity seekers. And then he goes on to say, but he was always looking for crowds of seeking souls. But it very clearly that what he had to say in his Sermon on the Mount was not meant for the multitudes, that these teachings are subtle. And as we've talked about in previous weeks, not that long ago in these teachings, it can actually even be harmful, both for the teacher and for the one trying to listen, if you try and share teachings to people who are not ready to hear them. And then we call those riddles, but we're just not there. Jesus climbed up on the mountain, and when he was set, he called his disciples to him. Master says what that line means, he opened his mouth and taught them, is that he allowed his vibration, his life force, he calls it, and his vibration to flow out to his disciples. He says, so that he could magnetize them and change their vibration, attune their vibration to his, so that they could hear him perfectly. And then what he starts with in that setting are these Beatitudes. So in the Beatitudes, the eight Beatitudes, there is always, as we have today, a virtue. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And the blessing, for they will enter the kingdom of heaven. And all eight of them are like that. We might not know that were we to read this on our own. And that's another thing I understood. Again, that experience that I told you about happened back in 2001, so it was 11 years ago. Actually, I was already quite a grown woman when that went on, but that's the truth, 2001. So it took these 11 years, and I read this yesterday, and I began to understand that even the very language that is spoken, we can't understand. Now, of course, this language was spoken 2,012 years ago. So it's been interpreted over and over and over by many people, in many churches, by many religious leaders. What does it mean, poor in spirit? But what Swami tells us, in this expanded, most of the light bearers who are up here refer to this expanded interpretation of these readings. This book that we read from every week is called Rays of the One Light. And then there's a series of books called Rays of the Same Light. And Swami takes each of these teachings, both the teaching from the Bible and the teaching from the Bhagavad Gita, and he expands his commentaries on them. And they're quite wonderful. If you don't have them, please get them and read them. They're really, he has so much more time to share his wisdom than he does in just these short teachings here. But at its essence, he tells us that poor in spirit, in this instance, means not poor-spirited, which he said, not ignorant in any way, not needing to feel, as other people have interpreted it, that we need to appear particularly stupid or particularly unknowing or always just staring down at the ground in that kind of what people call obedience. He talks about it more in terms of practicing humility, in the best sense of the word, of practicing humility. The way that humility can be such an extraordinary gift for any of us, because by practicing it, true humility, humility meaning we're humble enough to know that we need God's help to make our way from here to where we would like to be, or from here back to our true nature, into a sense of peace and joy and calmness and all those things that we always talk about. That humility in that way means humble enough to remember that. But as I was starting to say, what humility allows is for us to know the most precious and intimate relationship with God that we can know. And it allows that because, if we think of it, the lack of humility, whether it's in the form of arrogance or stubbornness or resistance, always wanting to know the answers, getting too set in our ways, hearing something and deciding right away why we don't believe in it, all those ways that we close ourselves down does just that. All of the ways we can be that are the opposite of being humble simply says to Divine Mother, I'm not ready to learn. I don't want to hear your teachings right now. I'm going to resist you for many reasons. We're too afraid. It's not our karma. We've learned in life, as many of us have, that appearing that we know everything already is a way to look strong in the world. All of those extraordinary misconceptions that we have really keep us away from God and keep us, as this beatitude says, out of the kingdom of heaven. And what else could the kingdom of heaven possibly be but that place where we remember our true nature, where we feel that divine joy, where we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we have this extraordinary friend who would always be there, that allows us to move among each other and feel that depth of friendship and connectedness, the phrase in divine friendship. All of what gets offered to us if we allow ourselves to receive. I mean, why did Jesus say so many times, so many ways in the Bible, the one phrase that we can all remember, to those who have ears to hear? Of course he said it many different ways, because we have to decide to open ourselves. Now, is it easy? It's never easy. It's simply just not meant to be easy, because we have to be willing and ready to sit for 14 hours, if that's what's called on at the time. How else could God really know that we mean it? It doesn't always mean 14 hours, of course, and it's always doable. It's always doable because it always means our next step. Recently, I read John Parsons' book, which is now out in print. You can all buy a copy. And I can't tell you how highly I recommend this book for many, many reasons. But I'm going to summarize those right now for you. But I will get back to why it's relevant to this reading. John Parsons is the lawyer, the outside lawyer, who helped to represent Ananda in the 12-year lawsuit against SRF, two lawsuits, actually, that went on for 12 years. And after that lawsuit was over, now it's been many years since it was over, I think it resolved in about 2002, I could be off by a year or two. But just now, John decided that he would write a book about the lawsuit, certainly, there's no doubt. As I wrote to him in a letter, I'm a physician, we're notoriously naive about law, we're downright stupid about it at times, and I understood all of the law. It reads like a novel, almost, in that way. So for non-legal people, you can really finally know. Many people at Ananda have said, I finally understand all of what really went on for these 12 years. And that in and of itself would have been a gift. But what this book does is it goes on to give us three other remarkable lessons. One is, what does spiritual community mean? And what does committing ourselves to spiritual community mean? What did these people who were real disciples of Paramahansa Yogananda, who were deep friends and students of Swami Kriyananda, and who believed in each other, and who were absolutely willing for 12 years to get out there day after day after day in the face of enormous criticism, in the face of, as you'll read, huge lies, lies that were and slanderous, I mean, terrible things that were going on, to walk out as exhausted as they were, as beaten down as they felt at times, to be holding each other up and to keep going back day after day after day, certainly with Swami Kriyananda's guidance. And if you haven't had a chance to hear Asha's talk at Spiritual Renewal Week, please listen online, because it really talks about the magnetism he put out at that time and how he helped keep everybody afloat for years, almost in spite of themselves and in spite of their desire to crash and burn at times. He would have none of it. But then the book speaks to what does it mean to be a true disciple? What does it mean to really want to move forward on your spiritual path? What does the term dharma, doing things for the sake of dharma, that which is right in the world that will serve everybody, that is for a higher good. You read that book and there is a deep inspiration that flows through it about what it means to be a true disciple. And then he has, at the end of every chapter, stories that are meant to show, they're about Yogananda's life, but they're meant to show us, number one, how similar Yogananda's life is to Swami Kriyananda's, or Swami Kriyananda's is to Yogananda's, I should say, in the sense of trials and tests up to and including this very trial that they just went through. And what happens when a master is met with trials? How does he teach us? How did Yogananda teach us to overcome these trials? People lying to him, people deserting him, people wanting to sue him, people bailing out at the last minute when, you know, the life of Mount Washington could be on the line, or the Encinitas Hermitage, all these things. You'll read all the stories. They're remarkable. We've never heard some of these stories before. But I'm saying it to you now because it is exemplary in saying to us, when we get committed, when we choose commitment to a dharmic path, there will be tests, there will be trials. We will have to decide over and over and over that yes, this is what we want to do. What else would we do? We fool ourselves in life sometimes into thinking, every one of us, that if I just slip back into this way that I know, if I just stay a little arrogant, a little unwilling, a little greedy, a little whatever it is, that's easier than facing my trials. But I just put it out there for everybody. Ask yourselves, is it true? It's never easier to go back. Once we've seen the truth in anything, we always want to move ahead. Once you see the light, once you see the truth, no matter what it is, the way you're treating your children, the way you're treating your partner. I had somebody tell me recently, I understood at my job they were actually asking me to tell lies. They weren't simply unethical. They were asking me to tell lies. Once I saw that, could I stay there? It's no longer easy. The very thing we've been living in, our very lives, become unlivable. So what choice do we have but to go forward? What choice do we have, and what else would we want to do anyway? How else would we want to live our lives? So that little line in the Beatitudes that says, poor in spirit, no matter how we come to understand it, it calls upon us. And it says, you have to show up. You have to find whatever it is that's going to be for you the ability to make it to the top of the mountain. And there's only one way up the mountain. If you want to hear what Jesus is about to say to those who have ears to hear, you've got to be willing to climb the mountain. But I mean, what will we do? Would we stay down with the multitudes? You know, not once we know, not once we're here. Because as I've said many times, those of us who are in this room, we already are those people that Master was referring to when we hear over and over, when one of the monks said to him, sir, I must have very poor karma. And he said to him, never say that. You have to have very, very, very good karma to even want to know God. And I would say to everybody here, even if you didn't know that, even if you didn't know, or you wouldn't use those words, I'm going to go to Sunday service because I want to know God. Even if you don't know what knowing God might mean. I remember when I went to the very first East-West kind of spiritual conference that I had ever been to. And I went because it was called Holistic Health. And I thought, because I was somebody in medicine who understood the connection between the body and the mind, that that was holistic. But when I got there, I was greeted by a lot of people who understood, who knew without a doubt that holism meant body, mind, and soul. And when Swami Satchitananda finished talking that day, I didn't know what he was talking about. I'd never heard any of those words. I'd never seen an orange robe before. But I turned to my husband and I said to him, I don't know what these words that I'm about to say to you mean. That's what I said. I have no idea what these words mean, but my life is different now than it ever has been. My life will never be the same. I was right, but I just knew that. How did I know it? Every week after service, every week, it will happen today. Somebody comes up to me. I say to them, how did you get here today? I ask all new people that. Many of you already know it because I've asked you that. What drew you here? And one or two people will inevitably say, I've driven by this church 10,000 times. That's always the number. They say that. 10,000 times. And today, I was drawn to come in. They don't know. We can't know. They don't know what they're going to hear, that's for sure. If you're out there, you know that. You didn't know. You were just drawn. It's what happens. We're blessed. We're graced. Because God loves us. Because everything in the universe is rooting for us. When I was on a trek in Bhutan, and I'll tell this story because my friend Dawn is here. She was with me. We climbed up to 17,000 feet. That's a trek. Somebody coined the phrase based on that hike, maybe. That's a hard walk. But it's beautiful. It was beautiful. I mean, of course, we didn't just walk from zero to 17,000. You know, we were resting and camping. But the highest pass that we went over was close to 17,000 feet in the Himalayas. Now, when you're at 17,000 feet, you're pretty much near the highest peaks in the world. So you're looking out over a lot. When we got up there, this was many years ago. I don't remember the year, but it was in the early 90s, I think. I sat down, and I simply started to sob. I could not quit crying. I just couldn't quit crying. And Donna was there, and every Sherpa kept coming over to me. Of course they would. They thought I was in trouble. But she knew, without my ever saying a word, that I was not in trouble, and she kept shielding me from the Sherpas. What was I crying about? You know, it's interesting. When Master talks about the Sermon on the Mount, this I just learned this morning. I just read this morning. He said, going to the top of a mountain, literally, physically, is spiritually important. He said, getting up out of the vibrations that exist in all the lower cities and towns and whatever people are doing. He said, clearing those vibrations opens you up. It makes you more receptive. He went on to say other things that aren't coming to mind right now about why Jesus climbed the mountain. Jesus wasn't just doing that to get away from the multitudes. After all, it was Jesus. He could have done it in a lot of ways. But it dawned on me, that's what happened when I was at 17,000 feet. I was feeling God's presence, even though I didn't know enough to call on God. But I'm saying it to you because these paths, these words, can seem so hard. And it's very hard for us to relate to it. We just got an email from our friend Karen this morning, who was up in Portland for a couple days. And she said, Swamiji gave a rather unusual or surprising talk. I don't want to misquote her, and I don't remember what the word was, but clearly it got a lot of people's attention. She said he spoke very firmly about how much will and how much power it takes to make it on the spiritual path, which is what you get when you read John's book, which is what we hear often. Well, that can be very discouraging. Maybe you don't have a lot of will or power or willpower right now. Maybe you just want to show up at church every once in a while on a Sunday. Or maybe you want to come to Med 1 and then you don't make it back to Med 2 for a while. Whatever you're doing, the fact that you were drawn here, the fact that you have a husband or wife and you're just showing up for them, whatever it is, without a doubt, we are here because it is our time to get to know more and more of these truths, because God is loving us, because in one way or another, he's putting his arms around us and saying, come with me. I'm saying it like the Bhagavad Gita says it over and over. If you offer me even a leaf with devotion, it doesn't need to be any great gift. If you just turn with anything in your heart. And Swami was speaking up at SRW about the importance of devotion. We talked about humility, the importance of devotion on the path. As I said, Sri Yukteswar said, Sri Yukteswar, by the way, who was what's called a jnana yogi, meaning he practiced yoga through studying. He was so smart. Most of us can't read his books and know what he was talking about. That's the truth. We've had to have them interpreted. But he said to Yogananda, we will help you develop devotion. And Yogananda said to us in Autobiography of a Yogi, through my teacher, my jnana yogi teacher, I was able to learn devotion, because we can't move forward on the path without it. And then the most important ingredient in all of this, so that we can say to God, okay, no matter what, just get me into the church. Just help me get there. Help me get there. Attunement. Without attunement, how could we know? Without attuning our energy to that energy. And yet, as I was saying a few weeks ago, here we come with these egos. And our egos that it's so arbitrary, what we see in life as being true and hold on to it. That's such an arbitrary thing, because somebody else is looking at the same exact situation and seeing it totally differently, which is so uplifting. It's such a wonderful promise. It's so liberating to think all we need to do is change our vision a little, and we too could see it all a little differently. We have to bring energy in. We have to bring will in. We have to bring power in. What an appropriate affirmation today. But we have the ability to change how we're seeing our lives. And if we just do whatever little bit of that, practice humility, practice devotion, step a little forward in terms of attuning ourselves to a higher teaching, a more expansive teaching, something where one's heart is open. You see somebody who's smiling in a way that makes you think they're genuinely happy or joyful. Follow them. Be with them. Come here. And then Divine Mother will take you, as I closed my sermon a few weeks ago, and it's coming to me again right now, unplanned, but there you have it, in our purification ceremony that we do. These beautiful lines, this beautiful promise that is whispered to every person who comes every week. Open your heart to me, and I will enter and take charge of your life. Do we have to work for it? Yes. That's what we're hearing now. You'll see this when you read the book. You'll hear it if we get to listen to Swamiji's talk. What in the world do we have that's worth anything that we didn't work for? And here we are talking about our spiritual freedom. What else would we be willing to put out energy for, if not to find something within ourselves that says, this is home. This is where I belong. This is where I want to keep coming back to. I feel love here, and I feel loved here.